Well, good afternoon, everybody. I'm Brent Blackwelder. I'm president of Friends of the Earth, the United States. We're part of Friends of the Earth International, which has member groups in over 60 countries. We're carrying out campaigns on trade and globalization and on the international financial institutions. I personally have worked for 3 decades now trying to make some environmental progress, and for much of this past decade have been a participant in the globalization teach-ins, because if we're really going to do something about what's happening to the planet, we have to look at the root causes of what's going on. And the root causes lie in how the entire global economy is structured. And one big component of that is what we're focused on this week, which is namely what these institutions of globalization, the World Bank and the IMF, are actually doing. So at the outset, I just want to give you a little bit of history, because some of the newspaper coverage is suggesting, oh, they're just a bunch of ignorant protesters there who've never been anywhere and don't know what's going on. The good deeds that the World Bank and the IMF are doing around the world are just not appreciated by the demonstrators. Well, that is just total baloney, because 2 decades ago, we were getting reports from all over the world about the kind of incredible disasters being financed by the World Bank. At that time, those of us working in the United States were preoccupied with our own disaster agency, the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers, which was damming up everything left and right, kicking people out of their homes, their valleys, and so forth. And we had organized people in an effort to fight. And we fought successfully, because over 150 of these atrocities were totally eliminated. And billions of tax dollars were saved. The environment was protected. But at the very time that was happening, we were getting calls from around the world about projects with unspeakable horrors being perpetrated by the World Bank, by the Asian Development Bank, by the other multilateral lending institutions. And so they said, we want to come and talk to your annual Dam Fighters Conference. We said, great. And we started instituting those sessions. They got to be the biggest sessions that we would have at the meeting. And so we try to get after the institutions. What can you do to produce some reform? Because most citizens in the United States had not heard of the World Bank, hadn't focused on it. It's not doing a project next door, so it was not a familiar name. Finally, in 1983, we threatened to try to get some legislation, and then the House Banking Committee decided, okay, yes, maybe we should do an oversight hearing. And so the House Banking Committee did an oversight hearing. And a number of organizations presented testimony, not simply on the environmental damage these projects were doing, but on their devastating impact on indigenous cultures and how these projects were actually spreading disease. It's totally shocking for people to have found out that the World Bank was funding projects that spread malaria, schistosomiasis, filariasis, onchocerciasis, a whole non-ending set of disasters. And the American public was unaware that as the biggest single contributor to the bank, we had this on our conscience. We were perpetrating it, and no one was realizing what was going on. Well, that was just the first of a long series of efforts to try to get reform at the World Bank, to get them to change their ways. The lending portfolio 17 years ago in 1983, if you looked at the energy sector, it was a disaster. Most all of it was going at gigantic projects. Big, grandiose dams, coal power plants, pipelines, and so forth. Well, now after all of those oversight hearings, after all the congressional legislation telling the bank to do energy efficiency and get out of the big disasters to avoid environmental damage, after all of that, what does that portfolio look like today? It's about the same as it was in 1983. In fact, in some ways, it's even worse. You've heard about the 25-to-1 ratio of the big fossil fuel lending to renewables or efficiency. That is the situation that we're confronted with. Why is that happening? Well, I put up on this chart here, which I hope many of you can see. Can you see it from over there, or should I hold it up for a second? Hold it up. I'd like to hold up the World Bank, too. Okay. I can't resist charts having taught mathematics, so what you have here is the Iron Triangle. It's what we use to try to explain how the Army Corps of Engineers was so politically powerful in the United States, but you could do the same Iron Triangle internationally. You take the World Bank at the top of the triangle. It's got the money. It's got the good housekeeping seal of approval. That money flows down the triangle to the government. It'll be the Ministry of Agriculture or the Ministry of Power or some government bureaucracy. They are interested in increasing their power. What country department do you know of? What U.S. government agency doesn't want to increase its budget? They're all after increased budgets. The World Bank can offer them a project. Who wants the project? Aha! This is often the hidden part of the triangle. Down at the other corner, the corporations, or TNCs, transnational corporations, more and more. They are the ones that are going to get the construction contract. They're the ones that are going to get the other thing out of a project. If it's the power, it might be an aluminum company. If it's a dam, it might be a particular business. All three of these are working together, and the money is flowing around the triangle in one direction, and it's flowing back in another. The kickbacks, the corruption is all there. The support for the politicians, it all comes through this Iron Triangle, with each tip of it reinforcing the other. Too many times, environmental groups, citizens, don't get it together. We're grousing at one another. They are reinforcing each other here. And so what happens is that's why a set of disastrous projects can occur. And who are these transnationals? More and more, the transnationals are the richest corporations in the world. You heard from the morning session about the lending for oil, gas, and mining. Unbelievably, more than half of the lending of the private sector arms of the World Bank, the International Finance Corporation, and their guarantee agency, the MIGA, they're lending for oil, mining, and gas. And so you've got projects that are benefiting companies like Exxon, Chevron. In Brazil, the big pipeline going from Bolivia to Brazil has got the Enron Corporation. You've heard of Enron. Why is it that the World Bank suddenly now seems to be serving as an entitlement program for the wealthiest corporations on the planet? Well, you can see with this kind of flow through the Iron Triangle, the kind of powerful, politically powerful force that we're up against as we fight these projects. But the message is clear this week. They've got to stop any lending in this sector. Get out of this sector. This is the single most damaging set of loans that the World Bank makes. Now, this triangle also explains the lack of rationality. One of the earliest things we fought in the 80s was a massive series of dams in the Amazon proposed by the World Bank in the Xingu Basin. We had great energy experts saying, look, you're trying to get a certain amount of power from these dams. You could get the same amount of power for one-fifth of the cost just by doing efficient motors, gears, appliances, and the like. What rational human being would want to engage in all of the devastation to the environment, the destruction of forests, the blitzing of the fisheries, the wiping out of the indigenous people, when economically, for one-fifth of the cost, you could get the equivalent return? That is the kind of perverse, distorted individuals we have over here at the World Bank. And I want to tell you, year after year, we brought expert after expert, academics, from the top to the bottom. We've talked to every single president, the presidents, and so forth, right on down to the lowest tier. It is an impenetrable, trouble morass. And the rationality is gone. So what you're doing here this week is crucial. If you're not blasting them with a 2x4, they don't get the message. If you're not threatening their budget, they don't get the message. And we really need to make that come out loud and clear. Now, I just want to say a word about the International Monetary Fund. Actually, do you know what the IMF really stands for? It's not the International Monetary Fund. I'd say it's really the International Millionaires Fund.
In fact, we maybe should change the name to the IBF, the International Billionaires Fund, because now the wealth of the billionaires on the planet exceeds that of half of humanity. Pretty shocking. The message in dealing with the IMF is not new, because that very same year, an effort was made with Congress on the IMF. We were there talking about the replenishment of the International Monetary Fund. The World Bank and the IMF were up the same year for money. They like to be up for money a lot. And the resistance from the part of the politicians. Steve Neal of North Carolina was the congressman in charge of the committee. A group of us talked with him. He said, now, you all are just sort of special interests, and this is operating on this broad, ethereal, macroeconomic level, offering prescriptions and recipes that are going to make the world better in every respect, in every way, shape, and form. And he said, we let you in, why every other interest is going to be wanting some change over there? And so that message was abruptly dismissed. Well, now, the question we found is that people grasp the World Bank, what it's doing, because you have a tangible project, a big, gigantic coal power plant, okay, a huge dam, a pipeline. But the International Monetary Fund, no, they're operating with economic principles. By the way, you can just put that over on the rack now. We've made the, man, the Iron Triangle can take a rest. So what is wrong with the IMF, and how do you capture it? How do you talk to people about it? Well, from an environmental standpoint, come at it this way. The International Monetary Fund is sending out a message to countries on how to manage resources. And that message that they're giving is fundamentally, diametrically opposed to sound stewardship. Because what they are saying, when you go to manage natural resources, is treat them as if they were just available and could be extinguished overnight. Go and get them, export as fast as you can, cut down the forests, mine the lands for export crops, farm out, vacuum clean your fisheries, ship your coral reefs all over, destroy it, as if there's no tomorrow. This is 180 degrees opposite of how natural resources should be managed, how we should be stewards for now and for the future. But that is their recipe. I mean, think of the message you try to give your children or your grandchildren. Don't squander your allowance right away. Think of the future. The message that the IMF is giving is exactly the opposite. In fact, the global economy is being run like a Las Vegas casino. Everything's based on the quarterly return. This is, we're treating the planet as if it were a business in a liquidation sale. We can't do that. That's the IMF's recipe, though. Liquidate those assets. Get them out of there, because that's how you've got a, that's your recipe for your economic salvation. And that's number one. The second thing they do is they tell the government to cut spending. Well, what does that mean to most governments? Well, they'll cut social services, education, and then we've begun to document what they do on environment. And so what they do is they cut out their pollution control budgets and their enforcement budgets. So if you look, for example, at Thailand, after the IMF came in this past decade, the budget for environmental protection and enforcement plunges 80%, while the budget for promoting industrial development, right on up. That is the message that the IMF says. Sell off your forests and your farmland, and then cut all the spending for environmental protection. And that means that the environmental laws, the environmental agencies, in country after country we've examined. The same thing is true in Cameroon and every continent, whether you go from Gabon to Tibet, wherever. You find these entities engaging in practices and policies that are simply ruining the planet and ruining the lives of the people that are directly impacted. Now, that chime means that we've got a minute and a half left. Now, environmentalists have been tagged as being too sober and having not enough humor, but I was glad to see Danny Kennedy gave you a few things. But the message I hope we can carry here from Seattle to this is that wherever these institutions are meeting, we are going to be there in force, and we're going to let them know what we think. But a couple of little jokes that came out of Sale I thought you might like to know about. There was a poll that was taken that voted Seattle as the number one most livable city in the United States. Of course, that was taken by Soldier of Fortune magazine. And then a month and a half ago, one of the people at the World Bank was just wringing his hands about the fact that they couldn't get any of those agreements in Seattle. They wanted that global free trade agreement on forest, and they wanted to accelerate the dispersion of genetically engineered food. And we beat them back on both of those, thanks in part to the help many of you gave. Yay. What this World Bank bureaucrat said, he said, "Darn it, the only people organized out there in Seattle were the anarchists." So let me leave you with just this thought. The global economic system is really the most protectionist, if you like to talk in those terms, because what does it do? It protects the biggest polluters in the planet with tax breaks, subsidies, and all sorts of special deals. So unless we bust that, we'll have more pollution. And I recommend Paul Hawkins and the Lovins book on natural capitalism if you want to try to envision how industrial society could function instead of being trapped by these gigantic big polluters who are crowding out every single good new idea. Read that book. It's a good one. And one final thought. Those of you who live in the United States, we are blessed with the opportunity to vote in elections without fear of harassment. Some of our member groups fear for their lives when they go to voting booths in other continents. But here, environmentalists, shockingly, only show up 50% of the time. It's about time. Get in touch with us. See our website. We've got to raise these issues with all of our candidates so that this becomes a debating issue in the fall elections. If it's not a debating issue, it's not on their radar screen. So think of that. Think of using our maximum leverage there. Now, we'll proceed with our speakers. And our next speaker is Catherine Caulfield. I've known Catherine for some time. She did that outstanding great book, In the Rainforest, that really brought to the world's attention the plight of the rainforest. She deserves great credit for that, and she's active locally as head of the Environmental Action Committee of West Marin, which is the county north of San Francisco. Not only did she do In the Rainforest, but she's got a terrific book on the World Bank, Masters of Illusion, the World Bank and the Poverty of Nations. She's also written multiple exposures, The Chronicles of the Radiation Age. So if you want someone that can really turn a phrase, read those books and you'll get some great information and you have some great inspiration.
Thank you very much. Well, the topic of this panel is structural adjustment. And of course, I never talk about what the topic's supposed to be, but just a nod to the organizers, I'll make a link. And the link is this. Why do we have structural adjustment? You know, why are there structural adjustment loans? The reason is so that the World Bank can stave off its own demise. The bank needs, a high up official in the bank once said to me, "We can't use $1 million pipelines anymore. We need $1 billion pipelines. We've got to get the money out of the bank to the borrowers so that the borrowers can repay the failed loans the bank has made over the decades." So above all, the what I'd like to talk about is the quality of the bank's lending. When I started to write my book on the bank, I called the press office and said, "You know, look, I'm going to be traveling around, going to a lot of countries, and I know those activists are going to give me a lot of names of failed projects. You know how they are. So why don't you give me the names of some really good finished projects that you're really proud of, And I'm going to India first. India is the bank's biggest client by far. Now China is approaching it, but at the time it had borrowed more than twice as much as anyone else from the bank, $40 billion at that time. And so, of course, the press office said, you bet, we'll get you names, so many names, you'll just be busy, run off your feet looking at them. So I waited, and then about a month before I was leaving, I called them back and I said, so I'm going on my trip, and I'm going to India, remember? And they said, oh, India, right, we'll get you some names. So I waited, and then a week before I left, I called back and said, remember me, I'm going to India, I'm looking for some projects, oh, we'll call you back. So the night before I was leaving, I called the World Bank and said, look, you know, I know it's 5 o'clock your time. Call me back within half an hour. Give me the name of something I can go look at. So they called back and they said, okay, we got it. I said, it? They said, yeah. Well, we could only get one because we were in such a hurry. I said, all right, what's the project you're most proud of in 40 years of lending to the crown jewel of the bank's program? It's the South Bassein Offshore Gas Development Project. I thought, well, I bet they didn't displace anyone for that project. And when I got to India, no one had heard of it. So I couldn't see it. No, I mean, I went to the World Bank's office in India, and they hadn't heard of it either. So it turned out that the World Bank in India and the World Bank in Washington were using two different names for the project. So I wasn't able to see it, but I got the report on it by crook, when I got back. And the report on this project said that it was very successful, had contributed hugely to India's development. And, of course, no private lender would ever lend money for gas development. So it was really essential the World Bank do it. There was a couple of problems. It had taken twice as long as anticipated, and they had to cancel the last third of the loan due to corruption. So that was the loan the bank is most proud of and its star borrower. Now, the bank's purpose, according to its own charter, is to assist in the reconstruction and development of its members by facilitating the investment of capital for productive purposes. And when the bank started, it had a very rosy picture of its loans bringing economic growth to its members, to its borrowers, and making its citizens of those countries prosperous, increasing global trade, and thereby increasing global prosperity and creating an interdependence that brought stability and world peace to all mankind. Well, it didn't work out that way. Instead, what we have today is a growing gap between the rich and poor, between the rich and poor countries, and between rich and poor people within all countries. And last time I looked, 70 countries now have a per capita income that is less than it was in the 60s and 70s. And 89 countries have a per capita income that is less now than it was in 1986. That's due to structural adjustment. The reason for this failure, there are several reasons, but a major one is the false assumptions that the bank was founded on. It was first founded on the assumption that there is a condition called underdevelopment, and that every single country in Latin America, Asia, and Africa suffered from it. So every different group of people, indigenous group, town, city, nation, they all had the same exact problem. And so for one problem, there could be one solution. And that one solution could be run by a centralized agency thousands of miles away in Washington, D.C. I won't even explain to you how wrong that is. I think you can see it just when I state the proposition. Another assumption the bank was based on was that countries can't modernize without foreign exchange and foreign advice. And actually, there's no evidence that there is a link, a positive link anyway, between foreign exchange and modernization or development, if they like to call it. What actually has happened as a result of pushing foreign exchange on countries is debt. And the debt situation now is so bad that, in fact, developing countries are actually sending more money to rich countries than they are getting from them. So our debt repayments are far outweighing the new loans that are being made. Development, in fact, is not a matter of GNP or money or foreign exchange or physical capital. It's a matter of the capacity of a society to tap into the root of popular creativity, of energy, to free up and empower people to exercise their intelligence and ingenuity together and individually to create a better life. And it's not dependent on outside control. Another problem with the bank is its structure. It doesn't lend money. It doesn't give money away. It lends money. And all its loans have to be repaid, and all its loans always are repaid. It does not lend local currency. It only lends foreign exchange, and therefore the countries have to make back the foreign exchange to repay the loans. And that's something, a classic problem called the transfer problem. Economists have known about it for a long time, and that's why the Marshall Plan, which was rather a successful effort at development aimed at Europe, did not consist of loans, but of money simply given away, because the United States did not want to have the kind of trading relation with the people, with European countries, that would enable them to sell the U.S. as many goods as would be required for them to earn the foreign income to pay them back. Is that clear? In other words, if I lend you money and I want you to pay me back in the same money, then I have to buy your goods. The United States didn't want to do that, and they still don't want to do it. And that's why countries are having a very hard time repaying their foreign debts. In fact, in 1932, there was an economist called Alan Dakin who saw exactly what would happen. He said the only way borrowers will have of repaying past loans will be more financing and additional borrowing. Refunding operations will become more and more the total of foreign lending. And that's exactly what's happening, and that's exactly why we have structural adjustment loans. They need billion-dollar pipelines, get the foreign currency out there so it can be repaid back. A lot of that money never technically even leaves Washington. It's just moved around in bank accounts. But the debt piles up for future generations of taxpayers in the borrowing countries. I don't want to give you too many facts and numbers because you're going to have information overload if you're here for very long. But let me just give you a few. 66, 44, 33, 75, and 100. Those are really important numbers. You have to remember them. And here's what they mean. 66% of bank loans meet the bank's standard for economic rate of return, 10%. That means a third of bank loans are failures by the bank's own judgment. Lately, the bank has taken to measuring loans, some loans also, as to whether they're sustainable over the long term. For the bank, the long term means 5 to 10 years. So 44% of bank loans are sustainable over what I would call the midterm, 5 to 10 years, according to the bank. That's the bank's judgment. In terms of loans that are both economically sound and sustainable, one-third of the bank's loans meet that criteria. This is according to the bank. If you were to judge loans over the long term for their social consequences, for the environmental consequences, or as an independent observer rather than as a bank employee, that number would certainly go down. So the bank now can claim a one-third success rate with their loans. They're aiming for a 75% success rate. Why not aim for the top? Why not aim for 100%? Well, the bank explains that that's because development is a risky business, and if they were to ever achieve 100%, it would show that they weren't taking enough risks. So that's their actual real argument. And development is a risky business, and it's a very uncertain business. Here in the United States, we have not managed to have a functioning health system. Our public schools are lousy. Our city infrastructures need a lot of work. And yet we, from here, are preaching to other countries where many of the World Bank experts have never lived. Often they don't speak the same language. Few have ever spent a single night in a village in these countries. We're telling them what to do. So, of course, it's a risky business. But the next question is, what is the 100 I mentioned? 100% of all World Bank loans are repaid. Because when the World Bank lends you money, if you don't repay it, you are a pariah internationally. You will never get money from any public agency or private lender again. And we have managed to create a world full of people who are hooked on debt, of countries that are hooked on debt. They cannot survive. They can't afford to default, and they can't afford to pay back. So you have to keep repaying the World Bank. And this is what really troubles me. Was that a ding? Oh, my God. Okay, this is what troubles me. The World Bank imposes risks. It does not take risks. I think the simple solution to this problem is for the bank to accept the risks that it imposes on others. That, in other words, if a project fails, to a certain extent, you know, say a project is judged a complete and utter failure or 50% failure, whatever it is, that risk should be shared with a borrowing country and the repayment should be reduced by that percentage. International Court of Arbitration, it's fully acceptable to the bank's operating charter. It would not be a problem. The way things are now, the bank has absolutely no incentive to change, not one. On the contrary, the worse its loans, the more indebted its borrowers, the more they need to borrow from the bank to keep those repayments flowing, and the more the bank says, hey, you're deeply in debt. You're just not responsible. We'll need to dictate to you a little bit more. Change those labor laws. This is how your financial institutions should be structured. This is how your land laws should go. The more power the bank has, the more loans it makes, the more money it makes, $1.5 billion in profit each year lately, which is not bad for an organization that has a .org at the back of it. It is not supposed to be money-making. And so the bank actually profits from its incompetence while its borrowers are pushed further and further into debt. I would say if there's one simple thing I would like you to take away from what I've said today, it's that the bank should take the risks, not the profits. Thanks very much.
Our next speaker is Emmy Hayfield. I've known her for about two decades. She's been one of the greatest activists in the world, helping to save tropical rainforests. She's the executive director of WALHI, which is the preeminent environmental organization in Indonesia, is a member of Friends of the Earth International. She's been a leader in the effort to expose the World Bank's transmigration program of resettlement in Indonesia. She's been a leading activist in highlighting the disasters of these global mining operations, such as Freeport-McMoRan's activities in Indonesia. Emmy, we look forward to your words.
Thank you. I feel wonderful to be here. I remember when in late 80s, we, with Brand, with Catherine Caulfield, with other friends, came to Washington, D.C. to stage a demonstration and rally against the World Bank. We were only 30 people. But at that time, you know, we brought bulldozer. I still remember Randy Hayes from Rainforest Action Network. And we made our voice. I'm so happy that now it's more people concerned about the World Bank and IMF impacts all over the world. So thank you for coming here, and it's very great to see you all now joining the forces. I'm coming from Indonesia. Indonesia has been under the World Bank influence spells since late 60s, when the former president and dictator Suharto took over the power in 1967. And right after that, IMF came and provided loan, and World Bank also came. And for three decades, Indonesia has become the World Bank model for development projects all over the world. The World Bank desperately needed a model to show to all over the world that their development approach is actually successful, and use Indonesia as one of the model for that. Even though corruption was very high, 30% of the World Bank loan to Indonesia was corrupted by the Indonesian officials. And when we confronted the World Bank about this, they said, "Well, clean. World Bank loan to Indonesia is not corrupted, and we are clean." And besides, the World Bank still supported Indonesia besides all human rights violations that took place in Indonesia. All land procurement by development activities that caused deprivation of the grassroots communities. We still remember the Kedung Ombo case in Central Java, transmigrations and things like that. Environmental destructions is taking place. And the cronies, the riches of the president, of the government, of the regime, was the one who benefited from the World Bank loan to Indonesia. But we were hailed as, not we, the government of Indonesia, hailed as one of the most successful poverty reduction program in Indonesia. We had the biggest economic gap, but the World Bank said that the Gini index, I don't know what is it, that in Indonesia is small. So it means the economic gap was smaller between the richest and the poor, despite the fact that only 1% of the population live in, can live in a welfare where, you know, we all want health insurance and things like that. There are so many structural poverty that caused by the economic development. There are so many. We had, since 1967, we had almost 3 million hectares of deforestation took place every year. And we had the biggest forest fire ever happened in the world, almost every 3 years. And in 1997, 2 weeks before the Southeast Asian crisis, monetary crisis, the World Bank published a report and saying that Indonesian economy was sound and that we would continue to grow at 7% in 1997-1998. 2 weeks after that, our economy crashed. And suddenly, our poverty level was back to 1967. 40 million people were out of job. Street children tripled on the cities in Java. Government budget was cut. Environmental budget was cut more than 50%. Of course, it was the first one to be cut. Crime increased. Illegal logging increased, doubled. And crimes increased. But blessing in disguise, that crisis has made us able to kick the three decades long dictator, one of the strongest and the cruelest dictators in the world, Suharto. We are happy to have him. More than 1 million people were vanished during the Suharto's takeover. Millions of people were jailed, and with no justice, legal process. And, you know, our environment was destroyed by his policy, one of the most famous policy was the establishment of 1.7 million hectares of rice field, rice, but it didn't happen, it didn't become rice. Conversion of 1.7 peat swamp area, peat swamp forest in central Kalimantan into rice field, which is now become an environmental disaster in a single place. It's the worst, you know, environmental disaster caused by a stroke of a pen. It's a presidential decree. That's the legacy that we inherit from Suharto. We now have a new government, a president, our own friend, who is, how do you call it, friendly and understand fully democratic principle. Although he is physically fragile and blind, but we put our hope to our future into him. We have now more space and voice and power. The environmental movement, I myself, meeting regularly with him. He listens to a lot of people, listens to laborers, workers, to the farmers. His heart is there. We have a lot of problems coming from the past. People whose land were deprived during Suharto are now coming forward and want to have their life back, want to have their lands back, want to have their water back. And those people are now getting voice and getting listened by our representatives in the parliament and also by our own president. But we found out that we have democracy, but we don't control our country. Those who control our country right now is IMF. The government wants to do this, and IMF said no. I would like to say that IMF, international corporations, and World Bank sabotage the democratic process that is going on in Indonesia. I'm telling you why. A month ago, Henry Kissinger came to Indonesia. He is in the board of Freeport Mining, one of the biggest single gold mining company in West Papua, Indonesia, which is notorious for human rights violation and environmental destructions. 300,000 tons of tailings every day is discharged into Aikwa River. And they have been doing this for three decades. And we right now have gained, we have been fighting this for the last decade, and we have gained support from the politicians and from the presidents to renegotiate the contract of work, to renegotiate environmental performance. But Henry Kissinger came to our country and said, don't you ever dare to renegotiate the contract, because investors won't come to Indonesia and you are going to be left behind and your economy is going to be ruined. Our government wants to increase the salary of the workers, the minimum salary, but it is being opposed right now by corporates, including transnational corporations, and saying that it reduces Indonesian comparative advantage. The farmers right now, I'm trying to control my emotion, our farmers now is suffering of low price of rice. We have a, after 3 years, this year is the biggest harvest that is happening in Indonesia. But under letter of intent of IMF, we have to open up our agricultural market. And since then, we have imported rice from United States, from Japan, and we have lots of rice in Indonesia, and our farmers cannot compete because we don't have price subsidy for our farmers. Where United States has price subsidy and Japan has price subsidy, we are forced to remove all subsidy for our farmers. And our farmers now cannot even sell their rice because the price is very, very low. The government wants to increase the import tax of rice. but IMF doesn't allow it. They said only 30% import tax can be imposed on rice, import rice. I'm telling you now that, you know, democracy that we fought for based on lots of sacrifice of our students, of our movement, now we found out that it's not there. It's not there. There are this global power that is controlling our country that beyond our control. And we have an increasing debt, even though we were growing at 7% since 1970 to 1997, but our debt has never been decreased, always increased. And now we are left with the legacy of debt, environmental destruction, deforestation, everything, and we're still trying to heal and reconcile with our past, all the human rights violations that we've suffered in the last three decades. And hence, we cannot control our transitions into a democratic country. And we cannot correct, and moreover, we cannot correct the mistake that was made in the past. The government is trying to listen to those people whose land have been deprived. And the corporate said, you cannot, you have to be consistent with your own decisions. Whose decisions? What kind of consistent that we have to be? Do we have to be consistent in violating our own people? No, we can't. And I'm happy that today, actually, our suffering can be shared with others and you all. I rely on you all here also to help us and voice how we in other countries feel about the impacts of the international, global, not international, sorry, Herman, it's the global power over our life and over our democratic life. And I'm great that you are here, and I'm great to be here also to share this with you. And hopefully on Sunday and Monday, we'll get this message across. Thank you so much.
Our next speaker is Carlos Chen of Rights Action in Guatemala. He is a Mayan Achi man. He survived the incredible repression that occurred during the construction of yet another dam project, the dam project financed by the World Bank and the Inter-American Development Bank, the Chisoy Dam in Guatemala. And we hear about enduring hardships. Let me tell you, he is now, since 1992, has been a leading human rights activist in the Rabinal region of Guatemala. This is the region where the army has engaged in the 1980s in over 60 massacres. The killings were just absolutely outrageous. He endured, saw that. He's bringing his courage and convictions here to tell us about them, tell us about what's going on today.
Buenas tardes a todos. Mi nombre es Carlos Chen Osorio. Vengo de Guatemala.
Good afternoon, everyone. My name is Carlos Chen, and I'm here from Guatemala. What we're going to do, my name is Graham Russell. I work with Rights Action, and I'm going to quickly set out the context of what happened to then let Carlos briefly tell his story. And at the end, we'll hand out a newsletter that sort of contains a bigger summary of his story. For 7 years, Rights Action, we've been working with Carlos on this story. the main thing we're in Washington for now, well, we have an office here, but the reason he's come north has to do with getting proper compensation for what happened and then reparations because these were crimes that were committed. The brief context is that in the 70s, the Guatemalan army was heating up the repression in the name of the so-called fight against communism. They were increasingly getting carte blanche support from the U.S. government. I think probably many of you know about that story. And this is one more case of a military regime getting carte blanche support from the United States and carrying out untold atrocities against its own people. And Carlos will talk about that. At the same time, in the mid-70s, the World Bank and the IDB, the Inter-American Development Bank, took the decision with zero consultation, which Carlos will talk about, with the local community, to build the Chishoy Dam. It's in the department of Baja Verapaz, bordering the department of Quiché, for those of you that know Guatemala. And so at the same time that the plans are going forward to build the dam in the late 70s, the repression is increasing. And those two things are happening at the same time. They don't yet intersect. It is when the community finally finds out, because a helicopter arrives one day and then without consultation tells them that the decision has been taken to build a dam and they're going to have to move, that the local community, it's an isolated community, no roads, no electricity, a classic isolated rural community in Central America. Spanish is the second language. Very few people in the community speak Spanish. They speak Achi as their first language. They've lived there for hundreds of years. They have their they had their Mayan artifacts there, their religious sites. They had their burial grounds there. Of course, they oppose this decision that's being imposed on them. They form themselves. They start a negotiating team. They want to enter into negotiations. It's at that time, this is into the late 70s and early 80s, the Guatemalan regime at this time has changed from, in the United States, it's changed from the Carter administration to the Reagan administration, up the ante. There's more support for the Guatemalan regime. They form civil defense patrols around the country, and this is when the massacres start against the people of Rio Negro. They're calling them guerrillas and leftists because they're opposing the dam and they want a proper negotiation process. And the massacres start in 1981 and continue throughout 1982. His community had some 700-plus people in it, and there was five different massacres over the period of 1 year, and 444 members of his community were massacred, and the rest were scattered to the four winds, and he'll be talking about what they're trying to do now to bring the community back together. The resettlement policy took care of itself because of the massacres. The community was burned. Everyone fled. There was, in effect, no actual resettlement of them because they had fled. And so today, they've received only an iota of what the Guatemalan government, in conjunction with the World Bank and the IDB, had promised them on paper. And those promises had been after a process of no negotiation. And so today, 18 years later, it's taken them almost 10 years till the early 90s for them to overcome their fear to start to demand justice for what had happened in the past. And then he will now talk more about what they've been doing and why they're bringing their campaign here to demand compensation and reparations.
Para mí es un gusto estar aquí en este momento.
It's an honor.
Para decir que ya no más represa y ya no más apoyo a los gobiernos.
So for me, it's an honor to be here today, and I'm here to say to you, no more support for dams like this and no more support for governments like that.
En Pueblo Viejo, Chicxoy, Guatemala, se construyó una represa, pero le costó vidas humanas.
A dam was built in the small town of Pueblo Viejo, Chicxoy, in Guatemala, and that dam cost many lives.
El gobierno de Guatemala hizo millones y millones de préstamos al Banco Mundial, al Banco Interamericano. Hablaron sobre un proyecto de hidroeléctrico para el beneficio del pueblo.
The Guatemalan military government of that time took out many, many loans to the tune of over $200 million from the World Bank and the IDB to build a dam. They said that the dam was to benefit, it was a development project to benefit the people.
Hablaron un montón de cosas a mi gente de Río Negro. Ofrecieron cooperativas de pescado, ofrecieron camiones, lanchas, puentes, y un montón de ofrecimientos, pero nunca llegó.
When they came to tell us we had to move, they made us a whole bunch of promises to my people. They promised us to set up fish cooperatives. They promised to buy us trucks. They promised to build to buy us boats. None of these promises were complied with.
Cuando mi comunidad empezaron a reclamar a sus tierras de que nunca ellos no querían que se haga una represa, porque para ellos la tierra buena es la que está a la orilla del río.
The people of my community never did want to move. They didn't want the dam to go in because the best lands were the lands that we were living on and they were next to the river.
Durante muchos tiempos, mis antepasados, abuelos y padres estuvieron, nacieron allí, tenían sus buenos cultivos, pero no fueron respetados.
It had been many generations that my people had been living there through my great-grandparents and great-great-grandparents, and they had their crops that had been planted there for many generations, and none of this was respected.
Cuando los del Inde vieron la participación o la actitud de la gente que no querían salir, empezaron a amenazar con llevar el ejército, policía militar ambulante.
When the Guatemalan government's organization, INDE, which was in charge of the project, saw that the people of Rio Negro did not want to move, that's when they began with the threats against us, and that's when they started to bring the military soldiers and military police.
En el año 82, empezaron a masacrar a la comunidad de aldea Rio Negro. Mataron 444 personas, entre hombres, mujeres y niños.
It was in 1982 that the massacres began, and all told, 444 people were killed, including men, women, elderly, and children.
En el año 83 empezaron a llenar la represa cuando ya no hay nada de gente. Algunos sobrevivientes fueron, quemaron las casas, robaron los ganados, inundaron todos los sitios arqueológicos.
So it was in 1983, soon after the massacres, that the dam basin started to be filled. The project was proceeding, and they flooded out all of our lands in our community, including our archaeological sites and our sacred sites. And at the same time, up higher up on the hillside, they burned all the remaining huts that we had there, and they stole our cattle.
Algunos sobrevivientes que hoy día que viven en Rabinal están en una extrema pobreza. Muchas viudas, muchos huérfanos se quedaron por la violencia. Están en una extrema pobreza. Mientras los gobiernos, ellos están bien.
And today, one zooms ahead to today, and the survivors of Rio Negro, a lot of widows, a lot of orphans are living in conditions of extreme poverty, whereas the government itself, the members of the government, they are living quite well.
Hemos ido con el gobierno y con los miembros del gobierno para exigir reparación, indemnización para las viudas, a los huérfanos, reparación de las viviendas de la comunidad de Río Negro, pero nunca nos escuchan.
We have been approaching the Guatemalan government for years, demanding that they provide reparations and compensation for the surviving widows and orphans and other members of the community to provide compensation for the homes lost, the land lost, etc. And they never listened to us.
Quiero agradecer a todas las organizaciones de derechos humanos por el apoyo, porque la verdad es que en Guatemala no nos escuchan. Pero hoy día estoy aquí y ya tuve la oportunidad de hablar con el Banco Interamericano también.
I want to thank all the human rights groups in Guatemala and internationally because in our country they don't listen to us at the governmental level and we need this support and it's because of this that we are here and we've already had one meeting with the Inter-American Development Bank to address this situation.
Sin el Banco Mundial, sin el Banco Interamericano, los ricos no pueden construir represas, no pueden hacer varias empresas en Guatemala. Pero el mayor culpable son los dos bancos que están aquí.
Without the banks, without the support of the two banks, the wealthy sectors in Guatemala would not have been able to build these dams in Guatemala that led to so much repression. And I find that the two banks here are guilty of their role in this.
Y es por eso, estamos en una negociación, estamos en el primer paso con ellos para que empiecen ellos a reparar todos los daños que causó la represa. Estamos hablando de reparación de los sobrevivientes, mucho menos los que se murieron.
It is for this reason that we are now in a process of negotiation with the two banks. We are demanding compensation, and we're demanding reparations for all that was lost, and without even beginning to demand reparations for the lives that were lost.
Ya hablamos con ellos. Lo que dijeron es lamentan todo lo que pasó. Pero para mí no es solo lamentar, ni que empiecen ya a reparar todos los daños, como ellos son los culpables.
In the first discussions we've had with them, they have come out and told us how much they lament everything that happened and all the suffering that was caused. And I'm saying that that's not enough. It's not enough to lament what happened, but they should come forward with concrete plans to provide compensation and reparation.
Y estoy muy agradecido con la participación, y como dice el dicho, solo el pueblo salva al pueblo. Entonces, vamos a decir al Banco Mundial, al Banco Interamericano, ya no más préstamo a los gobiernos, porque solo utilizan para matar, para empobrecer más al pueblo. Muchas gracias.
His last comment was thank you to you all for this reception, but also thank you for your ongoing support. As the saying says, it is only the people who are going to help the people achieve justice, and we have to continue to say no to the World Bank and the other banks when they give these types of loans to those types of government. And let me finish off by saying that I will hand out as many flyers, newsletters as we have that tell his story. This is unfortunately one more excellent example of how bad a project can go and how criminal a project can be. And that one thing we will insist on with the banks is that it is fine to lament this stuff, but these were not mistakes, and that this wasn't a tragedy or a poor happenstance. These were concrete policy decisions taken by the banks. They knew which government they were entering into to deal with, and they should be held fully accountable. And so, again, on my behalf, I thank you all for this opportunity.